Hello, this is Robert Barge. Welcome to Redemption's Table, where every week we will gather around this table with a special guest to explore the most appetizing ingredient in this menu called life, redemption. I believe in redemption. I believe everybody hungers for redemption. Everybody. And the truth is, redemption is all around us every day. It is a recipe that God the Creator sets before us every single moment of our lives. Unfortunately, so much emphasis is placed upon the bad, many have difficulty seeing, experiencing, and tasting the good. So I'm setting out on a journey, going table to conversation, to accentuate the reality of redemption in the lives of everyday people like you and me. A reality that, I believe, finds its ultimate expression in Jesus of Nazareth, who is the not-so-secret ingredient to the redemption we all seek. So, come hungry, join the meal, because, party of redemption, your table is now ready. Welcome to Redemption's Table Podcast. Here we are. It's Monday morning again. It's the second week in February. Today we are at Vestavia Hills. We are in Klingler's Bakery, and I am having lunch today with our special podcast guest, Ethan Milner. Ethan, welcome to the table.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for suggesting this place. This was awesome.
Pretty good, right?
It was great. Yeah. Why did you choose here?
I started coming here when I started working at Shays, which is right down the road, and so for the last 8 years, I'm always trying to convince people to come here, and so anytime I get a lunch invite, it's my first choice, pretty much.
It was awesome.
Pretty good.
We both had the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Reuben.
The Reuben.
Can't beat it.
No.
Best one I've had in town.
That's great. And we also had one of the top 100 things to eat in Alabama before you die.
Which was a first for me. I have to thank you for that. You know, I hadn't had the, what was it?
Black Forest cake.
Yeah, cheesecake.
Yeah.
So good.
It's great.
Taking
half of mine home.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Man, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be visiting with you. You are the visual arts director.
Visual arts, yeah.
Shades Mountain Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
So film is kind of your forte?
Film is definitely kind of my passion piece, the thing that I've been in love with for as long as I can remember wanting to do something. And at Shades, as we kind of formed a department, we started calling it visual arts. I still don't know what that means, but you know, we make films, we do the website and social media and print design and photography. Anything you look at, I guess, is what we do.
Well, y'all do it very well.
Well, thank you.
One of our podcast guests back in December was Michael Adler,
mm-hmm.
who's the worship director there at Shades.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I was talking with him about Christmas at Shades, from the first time I went 5 years ago, one of the key elements of that event that caught me off guard, how good it was the film that was connected.
Well, thank you.
And I learned that day that you're the one of the key components behind that.
I'm a small cog, you know, in the big wheel that we've been, for whatever reason, very graciously been able to build at Shades, where we get to make things like films, which I, you know, is not super normal for a church, and so I'm very grateful to have a place where that's okay and has become expected. You know, don't take that for granted for sure.
Yeah, I was at a conference that your church hosted last week, mm-hmm. a Songs Plus Stories conference. I was there for the stories part. You actually led the stories part because the focus was on film, but y'all allowed us opportunity to kind of see how your staff works together, your pastor Danny Wood, and all the other components that come to the table to make these incredible works that y'all are putting out on a regular basis, films. Y'all, and I told you, I sent you an email, and I said, wow, what I saw today was very much what working at Shades would be what I would imagine what they say working at Pixar Animated Studios is like, that you love going to work because of the collaborative effort and because you have a lot of freedom there.
We really do, and doing conferences like that really helps point it out, because then you get around people from all over the state who are doing a similar job or would like to do a similar type of work that we're getting to do. And it was a really, I don't know, for our whole team, we sat around afterwards kind of just being thankful, you know, that we got to work for the people we get to work for. we get to experiment, we get to do the kind of things that we get to do, you sometimes get so tunnel visioned into there's a Sunday every 7 days, or there's, you know, 15,000 big events throughout the year, and you're just going. So something like that conference was great to be able to talk to people and kind of take a step back and go, man, it's pretty unique. This is special that we get to do that. The Pixar compliment is high praise. I told you in that email, I'm obsessed with Pixar in general, the studio in general, but the Pixar culture, like management culture. Mm-hmm. As I stepped into a managerial role, Ed Catmull's book, who is the president, or he's retired now, but started Pixar, mm-hmm. was, you know, foundational for me. Like everything that he writes about in that book is like how I'm trying to lead my team and collaborate, and all the kind of tenets that he holds dear have been sort of guiding lights for me, working with a team especially.
Yeah, y'all did some phenomenal work. I've seen a lot of your films. I went back and caught up on some online after the conference last week. You put together about a 2-minute reel, a montage of film shots. And I told you, that could be Academy Awards is coming up this Sunday night. Of course, those of you who are listening, it was last night. So, but, you know, when they put together those film moments and put them together, the body of work that y'all have put out just in that 2-minute segment of all these different shots, really incredible. Some nice stuff on film.
Thank you. That was from the past. I think everything in that reel was in the last, like, 2 years. And I've been there 8 years now. So there's a lot more that could have gone in there. We try to do one, some sort of montage like that, you know, every couple of years, to just be able to almost watch it as a team. And like, here's a stamp of, it's been a good couple of years, you know. It might have been 3 years, that one, now that I think about it.
What does film bring to worship?
I would say when we started, it was all, that was the question, and it was all experimental. You know, when I started in 2012, they asked me to put together sort of a 5-year vision of like, where could film play into the church's mission and culture? And so I just started throwing up on the wall what you saw other people do, which was we could do, you know, baptism testimonies to where, you know, people are getting baptized and you can hear their conversion story or whatever mm-hmm. has brought them to that moment of obedience, instead of just being kind of this face that's up in the distance in the baptistry. We could do announcement pieces, you know, where we're talking about all these things happening in the life of the church, just a good way to get information across. And as I started looking around for sort of influences and things, looking at starting a church sort of media department, places doing sort of branded content, like taking a visual idea and tying it to what the pastor is saying. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the time we were just calling them bumpers, like mm-hmm. we'll just have an intro for the pastor to get up. But it was sort of a stab in the dark. We didn't know. It took a lot of experimentation to figure out what actually made that valuable. Mm-hmm. The easier thing immediately was, well, it'll be a good transition. You know, that word was like thrown around way too much early on, of like, it'll be smooth. Mm-hmm. You know, that we started valuing that as like a high thing, which is fine, you know. Smooth transition, that helps qualitative feeling about mm-hmm. a service. But it took a while to figure out, how do we actually set up a pastor? How can we complement where he's going? And we basically, over the last 8 years, have drilled that process down to being like, can we take an image mm-hmm. or a story and ask and use those tools to ask a question that then he can answer? And we only came to that by doing it wrong, it turns out, you know, like trying to, hey, what are you preaching on? All right, we talk about themes, we work on that together, and then we try to take and say that exact same thing mm-hmm. in a bumper or mm-hmm. a sermon intro. And of course, that was like, it was always terrible, because we would try to say the thing, and then he'd get up there and be like, yeah, that, you know, let's unpack that. And it just was backwards and not helpful. It was not a 1-2 punch, it was just like one, you know, again. And so it was just experimentation like that, where we were trying to figure out how can we serve our pastor well, mm-hmm. and then experimenting in places like in the regular worship gathering, and the idea of story, really, mm-hmm. that we started thinking about, praying about, you know, the way Jesus's ministry, the way he chose to communicate the kingdom of God, was through stories, mm-hmm. and that's a very important thing, and asking the question, why did he choose to do that? And there's a certain power that narrative stories have in general that is unique to in its ability to communicate things that or otherwise, you know, inunderstandable, or however you would say that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've, you know, made documentary pieces and narrative short films and tried to print kind of photo essays and journalistic sort of endeavors, to where we're just trying to tell stories. Now that's as simple as it gets, you know, just trying to tell stories in every medium, whether that's social media or putting a movie on TV.
Yeah.
You know, we just want to tell stories that do that, that try to communicate the kingdom of God in a way that it's not impossible to do, but mm-hmm. more difficult to do with a sermon or with a song. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I remember when I was 10 years old, I saw a movie that stirred something within me, and it kind of was a pivotal moment in my life. I started doing something really weird, which I'll unpack in just a minute, but the film was The Sons of Katie Elder.
Yeah.
John Wayne.
Yeah.
It provoked
Dean Martin's in
there? Dean Martin,
yeah.
It provoked something within me. What it provoked is this strong sense of justice within me,
mm-hmm.
of wanting right to prevail, wrong, the evil to be defeated. And I remember seeing that movie. I was 10 years of age. It made such a deep impression on me. And I thought, I'm going to start making a list of all the movies I see.
Hmm.
And I've been, and now I'm at, I think I'm up to 6,800.
Wow.
75 movies, something
yeah.
like that. I don't watch as many as I used to. But do you recall a time that a film provoked something? Do you recall the first film that provoked something deep within you? What was the film? What did it provoke?
Hmm. So I get that question as a filmmaker a lot of what's your favorite movie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always find that as an impossible mm-hmm. question to answer. I like the way that you asked it, because that's how I think about my life, in a way, the timeline of my life, which is that there were moments or movies, and often other art forms, but works of art and movies in particular, that I thought about things, or I looked at them, my perspective was a certain way, and then after watching it, there was this tweaking, there was this shift,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't look at things the same way after knowing, either from just like a nerdy filmmaking craft standpoint, that this was possible, you know, or in a broader context, that what it taught me, or what it exposed me to, was that life existed, or that life was possible. And I can't possibly think the same way after being in that person's shoes, you
mm-hmm.
know? It's experiential. That's what makes film amazing. It's experiential in that way. The first movie ever that I, like, you know, just grew up with, you know, E.T. and Star Wars, and was obsessed with movies. That was kind of what we did as a family, especially
mm-hmm.
my dad and my brother. That was a thing we did. We went to movies together and watched movies around the house, and that was kind of a way of my dad handing himself down, you know, to his kids. So a lot of like Sons of Katie Elder, Rio mm-hmm. Bravo, El Dorado, The Searchers, like John Wayne was a staple in my childhood.
You weren't named for Ethan Edwards, were you?
I was named for Ethan Edwards. My parents were watching The Searchers. The story goes either when they were in the hospital or before. And he's not a good guy in that movie.
No, he's not. But he's a very complex character.
He's a wonderful character.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, John Ford's probably best movie. But I am named after Ethan Edwards.
How
yeah.
about that?
So the first movie, and so I was just obsessed with him, right? And then I was probably 8 or 9, maybe 10, and I was watching Indiana Jones, mm-hmm. Raiders of the Lost Ark. And that question of going beyond, hey, this is really enjoyable, I've now watched this 50 times. You start as a kid to think, I know this isn't real, and that doesn't matter to me that it's not real. Once you start having that realization, you start looking and going, like, somebody, I see the way my family operates, got a big family. Somebody's got to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to be the mom or the dad of all these people. Who is telling these people what to say and, like, where to go and how to act and, you know, how many times? So you just started thinking about that idea. And at the time, my family's not like a filmmaking family by any stretch. And so that they were no help, you know. It was just thinking, well, there's some people making movies. Maybe it's the actors. Maybe I want to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a little older. It was probably 12, 13 that I learned what a director was. And that was when DVDs were coming out. And you mm-hmm. could listen to things like DVD commentaries or watch bonus features, behind the scenes, you know, things before YouTube. And that just like unlocked it for me, the idea that I can make people, if that's a job I can grow up and do, like I see my parents have jobs, if I can grow up and do that job, I can make people feel the way that these things make me feel. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of innate understanding of, like, you know, I did things like, you know, scared my sisters, and we told, you know, telling stories verbally. My uncle was always like the best storyteller I ever knew. And I always aspired to be, you know, be able to like kind of capture a room the way that he does with his words. Mm-hmm. And, but I was such a shy kid. I thought maybe like movies is a way that I can be like that. I can tell stories that make people feel a way that, and they don't have a choice, you know, I can scare people, make people laugh. I can like get people's attention with stories. And that all started with like Raiders of the Lost Ark, just kind of figuring, you know, putting pieces together and figuring out behind the scenes, there's got to be somebody in charge, you know. And then it was like making the High 8, you know, tape camera. You know, grandparents got my parents a camera, and we would just make little monster movies. This cut directly in camera, you know, it'd say 3, 2, and then you would hit record. And your siblings would do a scene, and then when somebody punched somebody, you would cut and go to a different angle, and you go 3, 2, and then you try to start it at the exact same spot. So just making dozens and dozens of, you know, bad spy movies and monster movies and all those things. And then there's just markers. This is a very long-winded question. I mean, answer. I apologize. But just markers in my life of seeing things and just going, I didn't know that that was possible. Mm-hmm. Now my scope, my view of what I want to do with my life has expanded even more, you know. Magnolia, Paul Thomas Anderson. I saw that movie when I was like 17. And that's a movie that I can recommend but not endorse necessarily. But I watched that movie and I went, you can do this? This is okay? You know, that you can, I won't spoil the end of that movie, but like it just blew my mind as like a 16, 17-year-old. And it kind of changed the way that I walking around in the world and seeing things and starting to think, like, say that movie in particular has a bunch of stories in it. It's 9 different characters all within the same story. And you start to just look at people like that everybody's got a story. Mm-hmm. As a kid, that starts to really work on your empathy, work on your sense and imagination that you go, and there's just people everywhere in this world and they've all got a story. As a creative person, that's kind of very energizing.
Yeah, and that was one of the first films to do that, where it was weaving all these stories into one touch point along the way. And a lot of people have emulated it since.
Right.
A lot of television shows now are following that kind of...
that ensemble thing.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned him. I wore a t-shirt for you today.
Oh,
but
man.
But we didn't come to the right... we came to the right place, but...
Did you have that from the set? And does your audience know about that?
No, they don't know about this. My daughter bought me this shirt.
That's fantastic. Yeah. All right, for the podcast audience, Robert is showing me his There Will Be Blood themed t-shirt because upon meeting each other, I let him know.
You have the poster in your office.
That's what it was. You walked in my office. I think you had just mentioned it about being in having been in a couple movies, and you mentioned There Will Be Blood, and I just went, you know... got super excited, red-faced, and I took you into my office and showed you my There Will Be Blood poster as a very, very important movie for me. And so he's wearing his There Will Be Blood, I Drink Your Milkshake themed t-shirt for me.
That's fantastic. I was going to order milkshakes, and I was going to drink your milkshake, but that opportunity didn't present itself.
Shame. Next time.
Maybe next time. it's interesting the way you approach filmmaking, kind of the same way that I approach sermon construction. Mm-hmm. God lays things upon my heart, but it's in the way, in the manner in which it first appealed to me or drew me in. You're doing the same thing with movies. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that have drawn you in, you're looking to bring those type stories before people that will draw them in the same way. So it has to touch you first.
Right.
Before you put it out there for it to touch others.
And for me, it's a way of like processing. When I learned that, again, through trial and error, that movies didn't have to be... I didn't have to be really, really certain about how I felt about something. Mm-hmm. That my job was not to answer a question. It was to ask it. That was very freeing for me because then I was able to use filmmaking in whatever format, big or small or commercial or however, as sort of a way of like figuring out how, almost like a bit of therapy, like figuring out, taking things from my life, questions that I might have, and putting them in other people's mouths or a character's situation or mm-hmm. something like that that helped me just process in a way, you know, process life in a way. And sometimes that's really obvious, I feel like, and it can often be a bit embarrassing, the idea that you finish it and you realize, man, I'm maybe a little too wore it on my sleeves on this one. And then sometimes it's like really, really subtle, though sometimes the things that I see and felt most clearly aren't really apparent to a lot of people watching.
Yeah. I mean, not every story has to be in a neat little box. And again, that's one of the things that impressed me about the films, their shades. Mm. They were deeper. They were more character driven, and they didn't answer all the questions. And cliffhangers are not a bad thing. Mm. There's a couple of stories, one in the Old Testament, the story of Jonah. Ends on a, we don't know how that ended.
Right.
We don't know if Jonah came to his senses, laughed and said, oh, silly me, mm-hmm. and went on being a better prophet than he was.
Right.
In the prodigal son.
Right.
It's left wide open at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those type experiences that, you know, you've sat in the theater, I know you have, I've done it, and get to the end, suddenly the credits start rolling and you're going, that's it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it drives you crazy
at
first.
There's nothing left for you to feel, put yourself into.
Yeah.
It was like they just answered everything for you.
Yeah.
It's dissatisfying in a way.
Yeah.
And it's hard to watch again, too. Like, being a movie-obsessed person, I realized that, like, I could watch a movie and really enjoy it for the first time, but the things that I loved were the things that I could keep going back to because I was involved in a way that was not just observation. Like, don't want to disparage it, but like I don't remember what year that came out. Transformers, the first Transformers.
Mm-hmm.
I watched that movie for the first time in high school or whenever that came out and was like, this is the greatest thing ever. The visuals and it's loud and it's so entertaining. And then I went back, took a friend back. I went with like my dad and then took a friend back and I fell asleep within 5 minutes. And I was out for the whole movie, no matter how loud and how visually interesting. And I realized then that it was... I would rather make the movie that I want to see multiple times, that I can get mileage out, that I can revisit year after year,
mm-hmm.
and no matter what's changed in my life, I start to see it differently. You know, those are my favorite movies, the ones that I can just keep going back to that well. And so my aspiration, I don't think I've come near accomplishing it, but my aspiration would be to make films like that,
mm-hmm.
that don't require it necessarily, but could invite you to come back. And I think the way you do that is just leaving some room for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I also learned the hard way through making Seven Shades that that's not what everybody wants.
Yeah.
That's what I love and what I want. We did a TV movie a couple years ago, a Christmas film we put on television, and the end of that movie is wide open. Mm-hmm. It ends with a question of basically, was this kind of in a figment of, you know, storytelling imagination? Was this in his head, or did this all really happen, and we're just telling the story out of order? And the moment that that question could be answered for the audience, we pan away, and we go look at something else, and end the movie on a very different note. And people were so upset. They didn't love it, you know? I mean, some people really love that kind of mm-hmm. thing, like me. But some people were just like, well, which was it? What was it? You know? And I was like, you tell me. I don't know.
But I'm willing to guess that some of the very people who didn't like it to begin with, they've come around.
I hope so.
And they've changed. Because I've walked out of theaters before at the end of the movie
uh-huh.
hating something.
Mm-hmm.
And only for it to, within a short period of time, after I start thinking about it,
yeah,
it becomes one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I saw Tombstone, another Western.
Yeah.
I didn't like Tombstone.
Yeah.
I knew that Kevin Costner was coming out with Wyatt Earp, and I thought Val Kilmer was cheesy in it at first.
Uh-huh.
That's just how it came across. Now it's a classic.
Yeah.
It's just like one of my favorite, you know, that's just an enjoyable film to sit down and watch.
Yeah.
And I'm not always right, my first
right.
assessment, because I'm wanting the story to go a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
When it doesn't go the way I want it to.
Right.
Well,
if it didn't meet your expectation.
Yeah. But that's not life.
That's right. And those are the best ones. If you talk about it just from a pure economic sense, getting your money's worth, you paid whatever, nowadays like $20
mm-hmm.
to go see a movie, something that sticks with you afterwards, it's like getting a bigger meal for
mm-hmm.
the same price. Like, you were left after Tombstone with certain questions that were nagging at you until you came back to it, or you even just thought about it. Even if you never watched that movie again, the fact that you were thinking about it later is the magical thing that like films get to do, you know. And in the church, if you can leverage that, where they're going to lunch, you know, talking about something or thinking about something, or they're coming back week to week, and we're progressing a story as it goes over the course of 5-6 weeks, it's building on itself.
Yeah,
that's kind of like a great opportunity for gospel-centered storytelling, you know.
Yeah, it is, and it's a good thing too, in to have happen in sermons.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everything's in a neat, tidy package,
right,
those things get forgotten. But when you're going out with, well, I got more questions now than when I came in the door.
Yeah.
Questions are not a bad thing.
Right.
They lead us to truth.
Right.
And where are the special places, sacred spaces in your life connected to film? Mm. And I think what let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the films that resonates with me deeply is the movie Castaway.
Hmm.
And I have different reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the very end of the movie, where he finally goes to deliver that FedEx package that has been with him on the island, the Tom Hanks character. And he's at that, he delivers the package, and there he is at a crossroads. And I know where that crossroads is. It's in the panhandle of West Texas, up around north of Amarillo. I've been there a couple of times, stood on that spot, and having had the emotions from that movie, I reconnect not only with the movie but also that crossroads in my own life. I've been there at a couple of different times. I was in the process of filming a book that I had written there, and I used that as one of my sites, and that project never was finished. But then I went back at a crossroads in my own life, and so that's what I'm asking is, you know, where are those special places? Maybe you have a connection with film, maybe it's an actual locale, or you know, sacred spaces that, you know, maybe you just know it from being in to seeing the movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think you know, whether that's just my family or all families today, do a great job of like keeping photo albums. Everybody's got a camera roll on their phone, but I often think about, again, chapter markers in my life in terms of how I thought about film or storytelling or whatever it was in general. It's a marker as to who I was and what I was doing and the things I was thinking about at that time, and it extends into making films, where if I'm doing a big film project, of which there's multiple every year, I get to look at that location again, or prop from something, or the final product, and I don't really think so much about the movie and how well or how poorly that turned out, as much as I think about the friends that were there with me, the experiences that we had, how difficult it was, how hot it was, where my priorities were at that time, what I was worrying about that turned out to be nothing. Like, I'm reminded of all those things a lot. Speaking of that 2017 Christmas movie, I went back. I had a commercial shoot this past weekend, and I went back to that same location. It's a connection. It's like a farm location, and it's a connection, personal friend, and asked them. I hadn't been out there in 3 years since we shot there. And it was like 4 days, and just, it was August. It could not have been hotter, you know, and where we're just in the middle of this field, 110% humidity. You know, it was just miserable for these 4 or 5 days that we were out there. And I got back to that location, and it was beautiful. I mean, I shot this past Sunday. It was like 65 degrees. Sun was going down. We're shooting a sunset thing. And I just was reminded, walking on those same roads, dirt roads and things, like how silly some things I was worried about were, how God provided for, you know, certain things, what all has happened in the last like 3 years. You know, you just get to like look at these little moments that are like saved to disk, these like cached memories via the convenient container of these like movies, and relationships are that way, and there's all sorts of things like that. And then when it comes to movies, like I think about, I'll revisit same movies just to like feel like I'm spending time with whatever that connection to that movie is. Like my grandfather's favorite movie was Rio Bravo.
That's one of my favorites.
And I've watched that movie maybe more than I've watched any single movie, because it's like, even though he's not here anymore, it's like hanging out with him, or reminds me of a time where we could just sit at their farm in Mississippi and watch that. It's a perfect, you know, revisitable movie for some reason. It never gets old, that movie.
Mm-mm.
I can watch it 1,000 times and I just can't possibly get tired of it. And so there's definitely movies like that where I connect them to a person, and by spending time with those characters in the movie, it's like I'm spending time with that person. Because it just, you know, it's like when a smell brings you back to a moment. Movies can do that for me for whatever reason.
That movie is mind-blowing in that it is 144 minutes long.
Mm-hmm. The perfect length.
But most films around that time, you know, they were coming in at 2 hours or less. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like 2 hours and 24 minutes.
Uh-uh.
And that whole movie is about camaraderie. About relationships, you know, instead of the lone individualist getting the job done, he has to rely on weak individuals.
Right, and the redemption of Dean Martin's character. You have all these, the generations. How about that?
That's correct.
I hope our podcast listeners can hear the cuckoo clocks on the
in the German
wall,
bakery.
In the German bakery.
It sounds like we're at Disney World.
It does. It's fantastic.
It's a small world after all.
This is Epcot, is where we're having lunch. But yeah, there's just moments like that where I'm grateful for, like, I'm thankful to have movies for that reason.
Yeah. I catch lines from films slipping into my life. Where it's, and I will say things, and if people are movie savvy, they'll know exactly what I mean. If they don't have a clue, you know, I have to explain myself, which I have to do that a lot too. But, you know, there's a line from that movie, Rio Bravo, when he's talking about, you know, the Ward Bond characters coming and saying, you need help. You don't have, these guys can't cut it. And he says something to the effect, it's what I've got. It's not what I've got, it's who I've got.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't even say that right.
And you look at it, and he's got a crippled old man.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this hotshot young gun.
He's not tested.
He's
not
tested.
Don't know if he can pull it or not. Yeah.
But that moment of, like, we're going to make the best of it.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Outnumbered, outgunned.
Uh-huh.
It's a great movie. It's a great movie. What other films, film characters, one of my favorite genres now, it's a genre that I've made up. I used to say I'm a Westerns fan, but now I say I'm a redemption fan. I'm looking for the redeeming moment in the film, and they're great redemption films in my estimation. These would be the movies that Jesus could have directed if he were around today directing them. What films come to your mind?
That's a great question. I mean, there's definitely, my mind immediately goes to the sort of like a spiritualized sort of realm of filmmaking, like the sort of Terrence Malick, you know, realm of things where you feel like that's a poet or a person that's in touch with something a bit in maybe a prophetic way, like a bit he's listening, whatever spirituality looks like in his life. There's a sense of God in the visuals, in the metaphor of like the relationship tree of life, about a father and how our fathers you know, cause us to view our Heavenly Father, and how can I think a God loves me, my Heavenly Father loves me, if my earthly father, this, I know him as stern and strict and, you know, hurtful at times. I think of movies like that. I'm trying to think of an example, specific character.
I think of films like It's a Wonderful Life, as common as that is. George Bailey, he's every man. I identify with George Bailey.
There's something about that movie that isn't family tradition, like a lot of families, like that's the Christmas Eve movie, the thing that we do together. And there is no movie that is more, there is a 100 out of 100% chance that that movie will make me cry. At the moment of people start bringing stuff into the house at the end of that movie, every character that you've crossed paths with tangentially, people that he perceives as not loving him and being obstacles to him the whole time, all come and sacrifice. Something about sacrifice in a movie, that is like the surefire way. Selflessness, the idea of like selflessness on display, surefire way to get like tears for me every time. You know, somebody having sacrificially either given or shown up for somebody. You know, in a war movie, you have like somebody comes alongside, you know, a buddy comes alongside his brethren in arms, and then that's like, I'm done. Waterworks, I'm done.
At the end of Schindler's List.
Yeah.
You know.
I could have done more.
I could have done more.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, what a moment. You know, I mean, he'd already done so much compared to others, but and then that one always causes me deep introspection.
Yeah.
Where could I be doing more?
Mm-hmm.
And will I ever reach a moment when I realize it all comes to fruition or comes full circle. Uh-huh. And I'm like, all the opportunities I missed.
That gives you a sense of like a jolt of urgency. The idea of like, we just go through our life thinking, insular, I've got to do these 12 things today on my to-do list to get it done, yada, yada, yada. And then he has a moment at the end of that movie where he goes, man, I spent so much money on things that didn't matter. I spent so much time on things that didn't matter. If I had devoted 110% of my life to this, I could have saved so many more. Mm-hmm. Once he saw where it was headed and all the faces gathered that he did save, it didn't matter because he only could think about all the waste, all the what could have been. And I often, that's an incredible perspective to walk out of a film with. That's got to be what that film's about, right?
Yeah, yeah. I heard Bob Goff say this. He's talking about conversations. He says, if you have the right conversation at the right place, you just had the right conversation. Hmm. And I've kind of taken his quote and paraphrased it. If you see the right film at the right moment in your life, you've just seen the right film.
Mm-hmm.
You have an example like that where that was true, you know, for you. Can you think of a time?
There's a couple examples where either in the film and the filmmaking or in its themes or its perspective, it has changed or has been a good, important moment for me. Like, I'll think about, I've wanted to do the same thing since I was, 10 years old. That's just a long time to be focused on one thing and to not feel I have a sense of ambition towards that goal of making feature films that I've yet to accomplish. And so I can get so focused and so sort of like goal oriented, even in my current role, that I tend to overlook how wonderful and fulfilling, and that sometimes your goals are just arbitrary. Sometimes you invent a horizon just to have something to look forward to. And if you could just snap out of that and realize there is no horizon, you would be fulfilling that purpose already, you know? I remember watching Whiplash, that came out in 2015, and I was 25, and watching a person pursue something so relentlessly that for 3/4 of that movie, I was like, this is what it takes. This is what I'm talking about. This is how I see myself in terms of how I voraciously consume knowledge about filmmaking, experience with different types of films, like just watching somebody, if you're not familiar with that movie, a drummer, go to extreme lengths to be as good as is what is expected of him by this kind of demented teacher. And for 3/4 of that movie, I'm like, yes, this is what it takes. And I was glorifying it. And then for the last third or, quarter of that movie, it turns so dark and goes to such a dangerous place that I went, oh man, what was I thinking? It was almost like getting in a car accident, like a near miss car accident. And you're like, oh, what? I gotta check, put this in check. Something's not okay here. Something's not right. And so I have movies like that for sure. But in a different sense, like a more of a, there's a movie called Krisha that was like made for like $14,000, and it's a feature film by an incredible director, first time filmmaker at the time, named Trey Edward Schultz. And he's just come out with a new movie that's unbelievable. But I remember watching that, and it was like all in one house, and he put this hour plus long documentary of making it on the DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And watching that for an hour is kind of just fly on the wall, very unproduced behind the scenes because they didn't have much money to put together like a typical press kit, and I was that changed the way I was like, man, this is so doable. He's just got a Steadicam operator, a good DP that he's got a relationship with, maybe there's like one gaffer on set, and it's just his family, who happen to be talented actors, and he's just a talented enough writer and director to make it all work. It's like, it doesn't have to be. I think up until then I was waiting on somebody to see me and go, hey, here's the keys to the car, enjoy, drive as fast as you want. Here's the keys to Hollywood land or whatever. And that was an important mile marker, because I was like, what am I waiting on? Where did I get this idea that all of a sudden I would just be somebody would see something, I'd be tapped on the shoulder and put on a jet plane to go make a feature, That just doesn't happen. This is, and that changed even how I approach work at Shades, where we started doing larger narrative projects that I had previously thought were unattainable. I was like, man, it's so doable. Just like, I just need a couple good people and a little bit of trust, and we can do a lot with that, you know? So there's definitely kind of important both things that change my heart and things that change my ambition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a filmmaker, and so you're focused on a story in front of your camera, and yet there's a story behind your camera. And how has God taught you in the making of film? How has He flipped the script on you? How has He turned the table on you in teaching you things about your own life and your own faith and your own walk with Jesus?
For a long, long time, and this is, I think, a benefit of working in a church where you are telling, like, our goal is to enable, especially in the documentary sense, when we're doing Shade stories, things like that, to enable people to tell their stories. For a long time, again, because of that blind ambition, because of that intense passion for filmmaking, it was, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to express. Here's what, this is, you know, it's this sort of ugly side of, like, and it doesn't always have to be, but the sort of uglier side of, this is my gift, the thing that I'm going to put out here for everyone. And what had to change, what God ended up, so you try to do a documentary, like you're trying to tell somebody else's story, and that's your ambition, it will be a bad documentary. If you're trying to impose your great filmmaking genius on, you know, Joe and Ann's, you know, testimony, story, then it will be bad. There's just no way for it not to be. And so learning a sense of just, like, humility. Like, your skill doesn't exist for any reason outside of helping, serving, you know? And that kind of had to bleed into the way that we told stories, that I'm not here to tell your story. I'm here to help you and enable you. I've got certain gifts and abilities and experience that will help you tell your story. All the way to, like, working on a larger film set, that, you know, making sure it's not like me and then 25 people under me that are accomplishing my vision, that I am trying to be a person that is enabling. Because I know, I had to realize, again, that empathy thing. You go, I wouldn't want to be one of those 25 people just a pawn to, you know, accomplish some guy's vision.
Yeah.
I want to be asked, prodded, invited in, enabled to do that same thing. So trying to be the director that then is also saying to everybody around you, who's got ideas, what should we do, what do you think, and trying to empower people's creativity, and that always ends up being the best thing, you know. Just realizing that, like, that model that you're taught early on of what a filmmaker is often just built out of hubris and, like, legend, and not so much somebody that's good at love. I'd much rather be remembered as, like, kind than remembered as, like, a genius or right, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to have a heart for excellence. We have to temper it with, even a heart for excellence can be deceitful. And so, yeah, I identify with what you're saying. I have been the eye charging across some landscape saying, follow me. And to the point of a few times where I've been like Uriah and turn around, it's like, nobody's following me.
Right.
I wonder
what happened. Yeah.
And I'm, you know, going back and repented of those times. God, forgive me for being so. I call myself that, a jerk. I didn't mean to come across this way.
Yeah.
I didn't mean for passion to trample compassion.
That's the work, too, is, like, the balance of everything, like, in life, just in adulthood. All those things, there needs to be, via experience, people do want somebody to follow. There is that aspect of it. You want to appear confident. And balancing confidence with openness on a set is a worthwhile challenge, you know, of, like, people can feel safe placing their confidence in you, but at the same time feel enabled that it's not your way or the highway, or that you'll, if something does not happen according to your expectation, that you'll lose your mind, yeah, you know, and start screaming and stuff. The amount of pride and hubris that comes with even the idea of getting annoyed, you know, mm-hmm, it's like, who am I to get annoyed?
Yeah.
And I have to fight that like all the time. It's just that I expected something that didn't happen. Well, whose fault is that? You know, my expectations fault, yeah, my fault. Yeah, it's a big part of it.
What I witnessed last Monday at that conference was a very healthy situation. From, you know, Danny Woods, your pastor, Michael Adler, worship, you know, and your whole team there. Just, I was like, man, what? It breathes. It has life, and just seems good and healthy. Good environment there. And I think that's the best testimony to the gospel, mm-hmm, that we could ever give anyone, regardless of whether we're serving cheesecake at a German bakery, or, you know, working at a church, or picking up the garbage, or, you know, whatever we're doing. Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to communicate at that conference, too. Like, we're very grateful. We realize it's different, say, a creative department to have such a relationship with the head pastor at any size church. Or any size organization, you know, even if you're a marketing entity within a company, a corporation, the idea that you're spending that much time collaborating with the CEO is very odd.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of work. It's not super easy and supernatural. Those people, CEOs, pastors, whoever, are busy people. Mm-hmm. And it takes intentionality and grace and patience and just a lot of work to accomplish that. That is not happen quickly.
You could tell that it did not. There was no magical formula for that. What's the line from Remember the Titans? You know, attitude reflects leadership or something like that.
Right.
What a, you know, beautiful testimony. Man, it's been a delight talking to you.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
We could talk film all the rest of the afternoon.
We definitely could.
And probably chase a ton of rabbits
in that
arena. Yeah. Here it is this Wednesday before the Oscars on Sunday night. Who do you have a prediction who will walk away with best film?
I am always so bad. We'll have an Oscar party every year, and I get it so wrong. Like, I'm the worst. I end up with the lowest score because I can't separate my personal feeling, what I want to do well, from what will actually probably do well. I'm hoping Parasite was probably my favorite movie that came out this past year. Of the things that got nominated, there were several things that I just loved that did not get nominated. Also loved Irishman. You talk about a movie about the themes of like regret and isolation and what choices mean. That was like a beautiful and important film, I think, for a long time. So yeah, I'd say Parasite.
You'll go Parasite.
Okay. I'm gonna go Parasite.
Well,
that's probably not gonna win that. So they will nobody hear. Put that on your ballot. Yeah.
Well, they won't hear this until after it's all done.
Yeah.
So. And I've only seen one of the films in that, the best film selection this year, and that's 1917. And I'm just, a lot of times the Academy will give something innovative. Mm-hmm. Like a few years ago, the silent film that came back. It won best film. So that one's in my head, you know, because we'd already talked about that before we started rolling.
Yeah.
Just, I feel like there's a 5-mile stretch somewhere
on
a battlefront that I know well because I've seen it from the perspective of two soldiers.
Imprinted on you somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, it's been a joy, been a pleasure.
Thanks
and
so much.
We'll have to do this again.
Absolutely.
Sometime.
Anytime. Please.
Thank you for suggesting Clingers.
Absolutely.
And those of you who are tuned in, right back here next Monday morning, when you hear the call, Party of Redemption, your table is now available. Until then, we'll see you next week. Bye.